KFI AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. You know, I want to remind you, I specialize in the science of love. I post videos every single day on my social media. You can follow me anywhere at Dr. Wendy Walsh, at Dr. Wendy Walsh. TikTok, where else am I? Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube. I'm everywhere, and I post videos every single day, so please give me a follow. I also want to take a moment to remind everybody we are into KFI Pasta-thon season. You can support Chef Bruno's charity that provides over 25,000 meals to children in need in Southern California all year long. You can go to pastathon.com and donate dollars. You can stop by any Smart and Final store in California, Arizona, or Nevada and tell them you want to support the KFI Pastathon and donate $10 at cash. You can drop pasta and sauce donations, any brand, any variety, at the Anaheim White House restaurant that Chef Bruno owns anytime between 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. every day until December 4th. You don't even need to get out of your car. There's volunteers there. They take it. So go to pastathon.com for more. This is our big annual charity here at KFI. And last year, you, our KFI listeners, made it possible because you gave a total of $750,000. So big deal. Keep it up. All right. You know, I'm an evolutionary psychologist. You know, I'm always trying to figure out like, what is our DNA programmed for? But what is our environment telling us to do? First of all, our environment is supposed to be outside and green in nature, and we're supposed to be climbing trees. I'm a funny one. When I go out for walks, anytime I see one of those trees that just looks like an amazing climbing tree, I literally have this urge to climb it. I don't very often, but I know that my ancient DNA is just, wants to get up there in that tree. In the same sense, you have to remember that sometimes our DNA is really, really, really slow to adapt to environmental changes. For instance, way back in our anthropological past, salt, sugar, and fat were trace nutrients. So we developed an undying craving for them. Well, you know what? Every fast food restaurant and every processed food manufacturer has done. They packed their stuff with salt, sugar, and fat to make you continue to crave it. And now it's an unhealthy thing. So when I say that our environment changes faster than our biology, this can cause problems in our love life too. And I want to talk about the ways that your ancient biology is messing with your love life. First of all, our modern environment is exposing us to too many people. Back in our anthropological past, you got to understand, we roamed in groups of maybe 30 to 40, mostly people who were related to us, our own little family tribe. And if a hunter came in from another tribe, he smelled delicious because his pheromones did not smell like our brothers. And we sat up and we took notice and we were very excited to mate with him. But he was a rarity. In fact, during our entire lifespan, our hunter-gatherer ancestors probably never laid eyes on more than 150 people. Instead, we are in touch with potentially thousands of people online, in workplaces, in crowded cities. And many people feel that their relationships feel hollow. They feel superficial because of this numbers game. Here's another way that our ancient DNA has messed with our love lives. Ghosting. Back in our ancestral past, sexual relationships led to relationships, like long-term relationships. And even when we had short-term ones, our casual partners remained pretty close at hand. So lots of evolutionary psychologists say it's so easy to ghost people nowadays because the relationships are so tenuous and they're not attached to other people. You just meet somebody on an app, right? Which brings the next problem. We actually have too much independence. For most of our history, our mate choice wasn't about you choosing somebody. It was about the tribe deciding. It was about your parents deciding. It was about your brother saying, I work with this guy. I've checked him out. He's good, right? Your family got involved. And when you forego the experience of your elders, you've got to try to figure out yourself what's good for you through trial and error. And many people are having a really hard time with that. Another thing that's happened in our anthropological past, the things you needed to know to survive were basically how to make a fire, what predators to stay away from, if they were going to eat you, how to forage for fruits and vegetables, knowing which berries were poisonous, knowing basically how to hunt. I mean, it didn't have to be a woolly mammoth. It could have been, you know, some birds and fowl and fish, learning how to fish. And most people knew how to do that by the age of about 12. And many of our hunter-gatherers were already having families by the age of 14 to 16. But now what it takes to survive in a modern urban society is, well, 12 years of school, 4 years of college, a bunch of years of career building. And what ends up happening is you eat up your fertility window learning survival strategies, education, and money-making. And so as a result, you're trying to find a mate at the end of your fertility window, which creates a big mate crunch. It's a scramble to try to find a mate at the end. And finally, we are faced with an information overload in our lives, which creates a paradox of choice. The dating apps do this all day long. The more choice you have in partners, the less likely you are to make a choice. And when you do make a choice, the less you value it, because you're always thinking about the bigger, better deal that was out there. I know. This is why I am here, because we're walking around your hunter-gatherer past and this ancient biology in a modern time. So on that same note, my boyfriend sent me this article today from Men's Health magazine about ethical non-monogamy. And basically, I'm going to just summarize it by saying, I feel like it was normalizing male sexuality for women, or projecting male sexuality on women. When we come back, I want to talk about what they got right in this article. At least they interviewed one of my favorite researchers on sexuality. And a few things they totally got wrong because they sure don't understand women. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. We're on KFI AM 640 and we're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. Not a woman on there. KFI, AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. So I want to begin by saying this. In full disclosure, I am fully aware that human beings have the widest range of sexual behavior of any primate species. You know how anthropologists tell how much monogamy or multiple pair bonding exists in a species? Do you know, Kayla?
They look
at the size of the scrotum compared to body size. Mm. So the bigger the scrotum, the higher the testosterone. Yeah, in humans too. Ladies, look closely at those athletes and then you wonder why they're cheaters. Just saying. We should actually do like, can you just show us a reveal of your scrotum size and then I can know whether you're going to be monogamous or not? Hey, biology isn't destiny in humans, folks. So calm down. Now you hear me saying that. And so at one end of the scale, you've got chimpanzees, highly sexual, highly promiscuous. When they come across a nursing mother, the first thing they do, they're so aggressive, they practice infanticide. They kill the baby so they can bring her into estrus and get her pregnant. So big balls, small body. Other end of the scale, you got orangutan, tiny little chestnuts, big hulking body, very paternalistic, very monogamous. What do we got? We have it all. This I understand. We have a wide range. But there was an article this month in Men's Health on ethical non-monogamy called Adventures in Coupling and Thrupling and Quadding and Even Some Old-Fashioned Swinging. Are any of them right for you? So let's stop for a minute and explain why this got me on edge. First of all, we are in a strange time of human evolutionary history in our urban mating marketplaces where men are sexually calling the shots. Generally, it's women, right? Because sex is a much higher risk hobby for women. I mean, when men have sex and it's bad, it's a bad night for them. When women have sex and it's bad, they could contract an STI. They could, because of all the delicious bonding hormones like oxytocin, fall in love with a loser. Or at worst, they could contract an 18-year case of parenthood. So no joke, sex is a much higher risk hobby for women than it is for men. But women have always taken time to be assessing. But we have some crazy things going on right now. Right now, we have access to birth control. We have access to condoms to help prevent STIs. We also have this rising, financially and educationally, rising population of women who are high-status women. And when women get their own independence, they can have sex for sex's sake because it feels pleasurable and it feels good, and why not? But what happens to men in what I call a high-supply sexual economy? Men are less likely to commit because, just like the old adage goes, why buy the cow when you can get all the milk for free from the entire neighborhood? So women who do want to commit are having a much harder time. Men are calling the shots. And the quote-unquote good men, we'll call them high-status mates, that have a good income, that are healthy, that are kind and smart, can easily say, let's just do a threesome. Let's do a throuple. Let's quad. Why not? And so I do want to clarify a few things that I read in the Men's Health article that they got wrong and one thing they got right. They say that according to new research published in the Journal of Sex and Marital Therapy, more than one-fifth of single American adults have engaged in ethical non-monogamy. But what they did not say, because we had the researcher who did that study on our show a few weeks ago, is that while 20% of Americans may have dipped their toe into some form of polyamory, only 5% are ever able to sustain it because we evolved to have this thing called sexual jealousy. The article goes on to say, generally, people put aside their sexual jealousy to pursue, to prioritize each other's happiness. Easier said than done. We evolved to have sexual jealousy to prevent mate poachers from stealing our mates. We evolved to have sexual jealousy to keep people from implanting and dropping eggs in our nest, right? Leaving our female partners pregnant as she's out somewhere else and then a guy having to raise it. So even though the article calls it adventures in coupling, remember, it's not such an adventure for women. Sex is such a high-risk hobby for women. I do want to say also in the article, almost all the artwork, the sketches accompanied in the article showed a man with two women. If we're really going to be talking about coupling, throupling, quadding, why aren't we showing a picture of a woman and two men? Why not? Okay, sexist right there. And also, the article ignores female sexuality. So female sexuality is so different from male sexuality. Women are far more likely, through their intelligent bodies, to bond through sex. Their bodies emit a cocktail of neurohormones, including oxytocin and dopamine, and they feel love. Plenty of women do. Now, there are women out there who can have sex for sex's sake. Go for it, ladies. Enjoy your short-term relationships. But many women also get hurt. The article also completely ignores attachment style. You know, this throupling and quadding and ethical non-monogamy may be great for somebody who has an avoidant attachment style, so they're not even aware of their sexual jealousy. They've suppressed all their feelings and they don't like to bond. They don't like emotional intimacy. Great, go for it. But what happens if somebody with an anxious attachment style gets involved in that? That's all I want to say. The one thing I'll say they got right is they say that any form of ethical non-monogamy takes practice to get it right and a lot of communication, a lot of sensitivity, and a lot of compassion. Right now, though, KFI, you know, is your place for news as well as talk. So we are going to take you live in Wisconsin, where authorities are holding a press conference on the unfolding story where an SUV just ran through a Christmas parade. Let's go to that press conference. Help me. Doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's KFI AM 640. Why does that music sound like he's losing his heart?
It really does.
I really did. You've got Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the continuing Dr. Wendy Walsh show. I want to let you know that when that press conference in Wisconsin happens, we will be going live to it. A little later in the show, remember, I will be taking your calls. I would be doing it right now, but I don't want to interrupt your precious heartfelt stories and questions with a press conference. So hang in there. After the press conference and everything settles down, I will be taking your calls with your relationship questions. All right, back to me ranting about that ethical non-monogamy nonsense. I know, I can hear you. I can hear the nasty comments on Instagram right now. What do you mean nonsense? It's not all nonsense for everybody. And you should learn more about the swinging community and the polyamory community. Yes, I know about it. Good for you. I am not one of that. I'm a serial monogamist and I'm very happy to be that, okay? I am not judging you or your lifestyle. What I am doing is warning the vulnerable who may not have a solid sense of self when it comes to their boundaries, warning them that maybe their own attachment style might lead them into relationships that might hurt them, that might re-injure them from early childhood trauma. Even in the article that I've been quoting from Men's Health magazine, I'm going to read you this sentence and tell me what you think this. Soon after they started exploring this, Jason was badly injured in an accident. An ethical non-monogamy became a way for Megan to get her needs met when he couldn't have sex. He occasionally feels insecure about others giving her something he can't, but he reminds himself how much he likes to see her enjoy hooking up with other people. Really? Really? No. What's really happening there is that we have, evolutionary psychologists would call it, a lower status mate who's now injured, trying to hang on to a higher status mate. I'm sorry. Human mating strategy is tragic. It's cruel. It's cold. It's also often filled with warm, loving bonding experiences. But it also has calculating decision-making at all times. And so when I talk about the vulnerable that might be drawn into relationships, I talk about people who might be of a lower status, dating outside of their league, going, you know what? He's just so hot and he makes so much money. I'll share him with two other women. That's a better deal for me. Well, if you know you can do that without emotional pain, enjoy it. But for most people, if they have an anxious attachment style, they're actually re-injuring themselves. It can be a very, very painful experience. And that's why I want to talk about boundaries. If there is one thing that I see from my social media, and you know, I post TikTok videos every day. Some of them have millions of views. This week, we got two of them with more than a million views. I look at those comments carefully because it helps me gauge and understand what people are going through in their relationships. And too many people, in my opinion, are in situationships, as they describe them, relationships with no definition that they want a definition. And they don't know how to ask for relationship definition. They don't know how to ask for sexual exclusivity. They don't know how to ask to have their needs met. Because deep inside, there's a little piece of them who believes that their needs don't deserve to be met, or worse, that if they do quietly express their needs, they will be all-consuming and scare that person off. Of course, I always remind people that boundaries are very, very sexy. That people who show up with boundaries from the beginning, and I'm not talking about anger, defensiveness, rudeness, I'm talking about sweet, loving, smiling no's, are the people that people go, they respect. People of any gender who have boundaries, people go like, wow. They're really hot. They know who they are. And you know who gets commitment today in these days of loosey-goosey relationships? Those who know how to negotiate commitment. It is a negotiation. And it starts from the very beginning. When you meet somebody, maybe the first phone call we've met on an app, in the first 30 seconds, you're giving unconscious consent for somebody to treat you a certain way. You're doing it with vocal tone. You're doing it with how you laugh, what you say, etc. I often say in the very early stages of dating that people should exert a little tiny boundary almost as a test to see if the person will respect the boundary. So that way, when they put the big stuff out there, they'll feel safe. A little tiny boundary might be, oh, by the way, my nickname is what, you know, my family calls me that. I'd prefer you to call me that. You know, maybe somebody's name is Elizabeth. So they say, he says, so Elizabeth, because that's what he read online. And she stops and goes, oh, actually, my family and friends just call me Beth. And then he says, well, I like Elizabeth. It sounds so formal. I'm going to call you Elizabeth. You know, right away, he does not respect your boundaries because he has now projecting his idea of you as an Elizabeth girlfriend onto the whole situation instead of going, oh, cool. That's what you like to be called? Great. Right? Or let's see, what's another example? A guy says he's out to dinner with a woman And he says, why don't we share the lobster? The lobster, we know, is the most expensive thing on every menu. And by saying that, he's indicating, don't order the lobster all yourself, because then I got to order the steak or the tiny little salad, because it's all going to be way too expensive for me. And her little nod there can be, oh, he can't afford for the big thing. And isn't that sweet of him to go to the most expensive thing and say, maybe we should split it, right? And so ignoring his boundaries is her saying, no, I want the whole lobster myself, right? That's ignoring a sweet little boundary that he set up while he was explaining something about himself. So that's what we need to do, is we need to start from the very beginning. All right, let's get into it. How can boundaries really change your life? And also, what are the 8 kinds of boundaries that people usually exert, and what do they look like? I'll explain when we come back. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We are live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. KFI AM 640. You have Dr. Wendy Walsh with you. This is the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show. Remember, you can follow me online anywhere at Dr. Wendy Walsh on my social media. Let's talk about love. And you know where love begins? Love begins with our first love affair, and that was the attachment that we had to our primary caregiver when we were very young. In fact, when we were pre-verbal. The big year is from 0 to 1. During the first 12 months of life, your brain triples in size and it makes assumptions about the world. Can the world be trusted? Am I safe? Who will take care of me? And if you have a caregiver who's there, who understands you, who gives you that love, who gives you that feeling and gives you that connection, you grow up to have a secure attachment style. And you will unconsciously avoid people with a lot of anxiety or avoidance around attachment, and you will go right towards those who also have a secure attachment style, those who can give and receive love comfortably. But if your early life was filled with loss, if it was filled with trauma, you unconsciously may reach out to people who will hurt you. Now, even the most well-meaning parents who loved their children very, very much may not teach them how to have healthy boundaries. Maybe they were authoritarian parents who said, it's my way, the highway. Or don't ask why, just do it because I said so. No, go to your room, come back and change your attitude. You come back when your attitude's changed. You know, I'm getting like pricklies up my spine just hearing my mother. I was quoting her right there. And I'm sure you had parents who said the same kinds of things. And so from a very early age, you didn't learn to trust your own feelings because A, you weren't given words to express your own feelings, and nobody seemed to pay attention to your feelings. So why would they suddenly start doing it at a dating dinner table? And you also, as an adult, haven't learned how to ask to have your boundaries met, how to protect that tender part of you. I want you to think of a relationship as a Venn diagram, 2 circles overlapping. If those circles are too overlapping, you lose your sense of self. You become fused. Nobody can remember whose problem is whose. If those circles are too separate, you're too avoidant. There's no connection. There's no emotional intimacy. There's actually a nice little happy overlap between who you are and who they are. And where you exist as a shared brain, relationships very much are 2 brains working in consort, 2 brains working together. Boundaries, though, are keeping that other part of you intact, even while you have that overlap and that shared brain. And here's why boundaries are absolutely beautiful and can change your life and the lives of others. You know, I'll tell you that before I get into my list, I have to sidetrack with a story. A few months ago, I exerted a boundary with somebody, and I was explaining to my therapist about it, how bad I felt. Like, oh, I'm so sorry I had to say that, and I didn't mean to be so mean. You know how we do. And she was like, you know what's really important about holding a boundary and having a boundary? It's that you model it for everybody else. And then everybody else learns to have boundaries because they see you with boundaries. It kind of becomes permission giving. And so when you see somebody's boundary, you can gain compassion for them. You can recognize their limitations. You can understand them more. That's one great thing about boundaries. Guess what? When you have good boundaries, you experience less anger and resentment towards people because you know you're in charge of your boundaries, not them. I want to remind everybody, you can't put boundaries on somebody else. You can only put boundaries on yourself, which means changing your reaction to them. Example, let's say you're in a situationship with somebody who will not give relationship definition and you would like relationship definition. You can say over and over and over, my boundary is I want you to be my boyfriend or girlfriend, or I want us to be sexually committed to each other. You can say it all day long. That is not exerting a boundary. Exerting a boundary is saying, I prefer that we are in an exclusive relationship. If you aren't able to do that, then I need to leave. That's changing your reaction. That's putting a boundary on yourself. Don't go there. It's painful. Put a boundary on yourself. The other thing that happens when you start to exert boundaries is you start to gain a sense of inner peace and safety. You don't need to respond to everybody else's self-serving demands. You don't need to be a people pleaser anymore. So you feel peaceful. And then you get to attend with your newfound time and energy to things that matter to you, not things that matter to everybody else. And I need to say this. When you learn to exert your boundaries, you will gain the most wonderful sense of self-respect, because that's because you don't put your own needs to the sides. Once you've drawn that line, and remember, you don't just draw it, you put a consequence in there, then you respect yourself and you feel so much better. It also, having good boundaries reduces relationship conflict. The relationships that are filled with conflict and fighting and arguing and bickering all the time are ones that haven't negotiated the boundaries. Nobody knows what the rules are. So they're stepping all over each other all the time. That's no fun. Also, boundaries allow you to have really good communication. And in a few minutes, I'm going to teach you some communication skills, what to say, how to exert a boundary. You will be a much better relationship communicator. You are going to realize your self-worth. Self-worth. Not the worth that you believe others judge you based on. Self-worth. When you have good boundaries in your relationship, there's less room for misunderstandings, all those guilt trips they put you on. You don't have to feel guilty. You say, that's how I am. You know, my favorite word for boundaries is my policy for me is. And the best of all is that the people you draw towards you when you have boundaries are the people who deeply like you because they can see you. You've put you out there. You're not running around people-pleasing and morphing yourself into something that everybody else, you think everybody else will like. You are just you. And the people that come around signed up for that. They like you. When we come back, let us talk about 8 kinds of boundaries, what they look like, how to exert them. And then I am going to be taking your calls and answering your questions on social media. I'm going to give the number out now, but the lines are not open yet. The number is going to be 1-800-520-1KFI. That's 1-800-520-1534. But wait, I'll tell you when to call. We got to talk about the 8 kinds of boundaries when we come back. You are listening to the Dr. Wendy Walsh Show on KFI AM 640. We're live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.